This will be Functional Morphology, Part 2. This is Chapter 15 from a book by P. David Pauly, or I don't know, maybe this chapter is by Pauly and the rest of the book is someone else. I don't know. Anyway, it's titled Limbs in Mammalian Evolution. More than 4,000 living species of mammal have infiltrated almost every habitat in the world. From the alpine mountaintops to plains grasslands, from aerial heights to the depths of the ocean, from slender forest branches to narrow subterranean burrows, mammals occupy an extraordinary variety of substrates. Some are capable of running, swimming, or swinging at great speeds, while others creep slowly along limbs or push laboriously through the soil. The limbs of mammals reflect the diversity of their habitats. The long, slender legs and two-toed feet of the antelope allow it to survey the plains for predators and bound off at their approach. The short, muscled arms and broad, thick-clawed hands of the mole scrape through soil as the animal searches for worms and grubs. Spidery, elongated hands and fingers with webs of skin between them propel bats on their erratic chases after night-flying insects. Dense, paddle-like fins steer whales through the watery course on which they are propelled by their massive tail flukes. Limbs are crucial for mammalian locomotion, social behavior, and feeding. The functional diversity of mammal limbs is facilitated by sometimes subtle structural differences. A small discrepancy in the proportion of one limb segment and its distal neighbor can translate into a significant disparity in running speed. The position of a muscle insertion along a bone shaft can make the difference between a mammal that can tear its way through thick turf and one that cannot. A fusion of two bones in the forearm or wrist may mean that one animal cannot turn its palm to grasp a limb as it tries to climb, while another species can easily wrap its forelimbs around a tree trunk and scamper to safety. A large part of a mammal's lifestyle can, therefore, be read in the structure of its limbs. This first chapter reviews the anatomical structure of the mammalian limb. Some brief mention of comparative differences is made in relation to structure, but those are reserved for the most striking ones, in which the number of elements differs or the structure of homologous elements is particularly diverse. Special emphasis is given to the structures that are most obviously related to function. The chapter then reviews the perspective of gross ecomorphological categories, groups that are primarily locomotory in nature. The chapter then reviews aspects of variation, genetics, and development of the mammalian limb. Finally, the early evolution of the mammalian limb is reviewed. This chapter concentrates on terrestrial mammals. Bats and gliding mammals are covered by Gatesy and Middleton, chapter 16. So they do all write their own chapter with separate authors. And whales and aquatic mammals by Thewissen and Taylor, chapter 18 in this volume. General considerations. Mammalian taxonomy. On all points except the most major, the taxonomy in this chapter follows McKenna and Bell's 1997 classification of mammals above the species level. The name Mammalia, large figure, is here used to designate the earliest common ancestor of living mammals to have an exclusively dentary squamosal jaw joint, and all descendants of that ancestor. This traditional usage differs from that of some authors who have restricted the name Mammalia to the crown group, the last common ancestor of living monotremes, marsupials, and placentals, and the descendants of that ancestor, and used the name Mammalia forms for the more inclusive group of animals with a dentary squamosal jaw joint. Metatheria and Eutheria are used in this paper for marsupial and placental mammals, respectively, rather than McKenna and Bell's use of marsupialia and placentalia. I like metatheria and eutheria better. Those sound dumb. Several higher taxonomic categories of mammal are frequently referred to in this paper. Therians are the group that includes metatherians and eutherians, and their last common ancestor and the descendants of that ancestor. These mammals share the tribosphenic molar pattern and many specializations in the skeleton. Monotremes are non-therian mammals that live today in Australia and New Zealand. Multituberculates were non-therian mammals that are now extinct, but were diverse and geographically widespread during the Mesozoic and early Cenozoic. Archonta is the group of eutherian mammals that includes primates, bats, dermopterans, that is, flying lemurs, and skindentians, tree shrews. Ungulata is the group of eutherian mammals that includes perissodactyls, horses, rhinos, and tapirs, and artiodactyls, pigs, camels, deer, cattle, antelope, etc. Anatomical terminology. Anatomical structure names follow standard paleontological and zoological usage, which is essentially that of Romer and Parsons, 1977. This usage differs in details from standard usage in anthropological, medical, and veterinary disciplines. The greatest discrepancies are in the names of carpal and tarsal bones. Many anatomies have been published that include the limbs of one or more species of mammal. Two of the most detailed are Gray's anatomy of the human and Miller's anatomy of the dog. This general anatomical structure of the limbs presented here owes a great debt to these works. Structure and function of mammalian limbs. General. The mammalian appendicular skeleton differs from that of other vertebrates in several respects. Mammals have fewer bony elements than most other vertebrates, although the evolutionary reduction of the number of bones is compensated for by an increase in the number of muscles. With the exception of monotremes, the mammalian pectoral girdle has been reduced to a single major bone, the scapula, which incorporates a remnant of the coracoid. The number of carpals has been reduced to 9 or fewer elements, and the tarsals to 7 or fewer. Mammals typically have an upright posture, with the humerus and femur oriented almost vertically. Compared to other tetrapods, limb movement during terrestrial locomotion is roughly in a parasagittal plane. See Jenkins and Kuznetsov, 1977, for a nuanced discussion, and see Inuzuka, 1984, for an argument that Demostylians, an extinct group of manatee-like eutherian mammals, had a sprawling posture. The rotation of the limbs into an upright stance was correlated with changes in the configuration of distal limb elements, notably the repositioning of the tarsals so that the astragalus sits partially atop the calcaneum. Bony processes for the insertion of extensor muscles are also especially well developed in mammals, particularly in the olecranon process of the ulna, the greater trochanter of the femur, and the tubercle of the calcaneum. The pelvis of mammals is also recognized with a long ilium that positions the pelvis caudoventrally to its sacral attachment. Mammals and many of their synapsid relatives also have a ventral contact between the pubis and ischium, which encloses the obturator foramen. Most of these skeletal changes are associated with changes in the posture of mammals and correlated to muscular reorganizations that give mammals very fast and efficient modes of locomotion. A large part of the diversity of mammalian limb morphology can be summarized by their stance. Habitual standing limb postures have been categorized as plantigrade, digitigrade, and unguligrade. Plantigrade mammals stand with the carpals and tarsals in contact with the substrate. Digitigrade mammals stand on the ends of their metapodials, with the carpus and tarsus raised above the substrate. Unguligrade mammals carry the digitigrade stance further and stand on the very tips of their digits. These categories form a continuum, especially between plantigrade and digitigrade, and some mammals have multiple stances depending on the situation. Each stance position has consequences for locomotion. Plantigrade mammals are able to use the feet for forward propulsion to a greater extent than digitigrade or unguligrade mammals. Digitigrade mammals gain an extra limb segment and a proportionally longer distal limb, which increases the length of stride and thus the speed of movement, but they are more reliant on the proximal limb for forward momentum. Unguligrade mammals gain yet more segments and distal length, enabling them to move quickly and efficiently. Pectoral girdle. The pectoral girdle of mammals is light and mobile. In therians, the girdle is composed of a large scapula, a small coracoid fused to the scapular head, and often a clavicle. The girdle is embedded in a muscular sling that provides scapular mobility and bodily support. When present, the clavicle connects the scapula and the sternum, but otherwise the pectoral girdle has no bony connection to the rest of the skeleton. Body weight in mammals is transmitted to the forelimb via the serratus muscle complex, which suspends the thorax from the dorsal margin of the scapula. Weight is transmitted through the scapula to the limb via the glenoid fossa of the scapula, which forms the proximal part of the shoulder joint. The pectoral girdle also serves as a point of origin for the muscles of the arm. The pectoral girdle thus provides support, offers propulsive power, and helps absorb the impact of the forelimb during locomotion. In monotremes and many extinct mammalian groups, the pectoral girdle is more bulky and retains bones that were lost in therians, including the anterior clavicle or proclavicle and interclavicle. These animals retain a sprawling posture, and the humerus transmits a medial well as well as a vertical force vector into the pectoral girdle. Consequently, the left and right girdles are braced at the midline via the clavicle, anterior coracoid, and interclavicles. The buttressing helps prevent the collapse of the shoulders. Scapula structure. The scapula of therian mammals is a large, flat, triangular bone that tapers distally into a neck supporting the articular region. The lateral surface is bisected by a raised spine that divides the supraspinous and infraspinous fossae. The spine terminates distally in the acromion process, which overhangs the proximal humerus. The distal scapula has a round depression called the glenoid cavity, which receives the humeral head to form the shoulder joint. The coracoid process, composed of the vestigial coracoid bone, asterisk according to some authors but not others, projects around the cranial side of the glenoid. The cranial border of the scapula is usually gently curved, while the dorsal and caudal borders come together in an angle known as the teres process. The costal surface of the scapula is shallowly concave and almost completely occupied by the subscapular fossa. In some mammals, notably perissodactyls and artiodactyls, the dorsal portion of the scapula is unossified and is composed in the adult of cartilage. Comparative function. The shape and size of the scapula and its muscular attachments reflect the locomotory habit of the animal. The primary functional components of the scapulae are 1, the relative breadth of the proximal scapula blade from the teres process to the cranial border, which determines the moment arms of flexors and extensors of the shoulder, 2, the orientation of the scapular axis, which relates to whether the scapula contributes substantially to limb flexion and extension, and 3, the size and shape of the acromion, and coracoid processes, which are related to the size and moment arms of the shoulder muscles. Cursorial running mammals, for example, usually have a long, narrow, vertically oriented scapular blade that helps increase stride length. Ambulatory or unspecialized terrestrial mammals may also have a narrow scapula, but it is usually more horizontally oriented. Fossorial, digging, and natatorial, swimming, mammals usually have a triangular blade with a large, robust teres process that provides the teres major muscle with more efficient leverage for powerful adduction of the limb, forelimb. In some fossorial and natatorial animals, a second low spine divides the infraspinous and the teres fossae. I think that's a thing in sea lions. Clavicle structure. The clavicle is a long bone that connects the scapula and the sternum, but which is rudimentary or absent in many mammalian groups. When present, the bone is usually a bowed shaft that attaches at its medial end to the manubrium of the sternum via the saddle-shaped synovial joint, and at its distal end to the acromion of the scapula via a flat joint. The clavicle is a dermal or intermembranous bone and is the only such bone to retain in the therian pectoral girdle. Despite this developmental categorization, the clavicle develops in part from cartilaginous precursors, and it has multiple primary and secondary ossification centers. In humans, 2 primary intermembranous ossification centers form and quickly fuse as ossification proceeds. True cartilage is formed at the medial and lateral ends, which are engulfed by expanding ossification. Further endochondral growth proceeds from the ends, and there are also 2 endochondral epiphyses that form. A secondary ossification center later appears at the sternal end. The 2 primary ossification centers correspond to the attachment points of the sternocleidomastoid and the trapezius muscles. The clavicle is the first postcranial element to ossify in therians, but its ossification may not be complete until after sexual maturity. Several muscles may attach to the clavicle, leaving their imprint on the bone. When the clavicle is fully developed, as in humans, the clavicular head of the deltoid muscle is often attached to the ventral border of the lateral end, and the trapezius to the dorsal. The sternocleidomastoid, or its equivalent, inserts on the cranial border of the medial end, and the subclavius muscle originates from the ventral border. The pectoralis major originates from the ventral border of the medial end. In groups with a reduced clavicle, such as dogs, sternocleidomastoid cleidomastoid and clavicular head of the deltoid form a more or less continuous muscle with a splinter-like clavicle embedded in a tendinous sheath at the level of the shoulder. Absence of the clavicle can occur individually in normally claviculate species. In humans, for example, the clinical condition of cleidocranial dysplasia may present symptoms of reduced or absent clavicles. Cleidocranial dysplasia can be caused by a mutation in one or both copies of the CBFA1 gene, which has its most profound effects on the ossification, actually that might be an I, not a 1, on the ossification of membranous bone. In domestic dogs, which have small clavicles unattached to other bones, the clavicle is variable in both size and degree of ossification. Among living mammals, monotremes have an exceptional clavicle, which is solidly attached to the rest of the pectoral girdle and has a much different function than in the other groups. The emballoneurid ghost bats, Dicyclodurus, may also have an unusual clavicle, which is flattened and triangular with pronounced processes mid-shaft. Comparative function. The clavicle has two major functions. It participates in shoulder movement, and it maintains a fixed distance between the shoulder joint and the sternum. The clavicle's exact role depends on the presence of the bone itself and the configuration of the muscles attached to it. In humans, for example, the clavicle plays an important role in lifting the shoulder, where it acts as a lever with the fulcrum at the manubrium. The trapezius, which inserts at the distal end, pulls the clavicle cranially and thus raises the shoulder. This movement is facilitated by the caudal translation of the proximal end of the scapula across its cartilaginous disc, powered by the pectoralis major. In humans, the bony clavicle adds stability to movements when the forelimb is used for manipulation and contributes to the arcuate movement of the shoulder. In the domestic dog, where the clavicle is reduced to a splint of bone, the bone serves as an interface between the cleidocervicalis and cleidobranchialis muscles. The bone's ligamentous attachments to the sternum and the scapular head prevent the scapula from moving too far caudally and allow it to be pulled cranially by the clavicular muscles. Evolutionary loss of the clavicle allows the shoulder to move parallel to the thorax, an adaptation for cursoriality. But its absence in species that are normally claviculate results in shoulder collapse. Those mammals that retain the clavicle, such as most marsupials, primates, and bats, often use the manus to climb, fly, or manipulate objects. Humerus structure. The humerus is the only bone of the brachium. It supports the weight of the anterior body in quadrupeds, serves as the insertion point for muscles in moving the brachium, and is the point of origination for muscles moving the forelimb and manus. In most groups, the humerus has a long cylindrical shaft with a rounded proximal head and a flared distal condylar region. At its proximal end, the head of the humerus articulates with the glenoid fossa of the scapula. The proximal humerus usually has four tubercles, or tuberosities, depending on their size and shape, for muscle attachments, two immediately adjacent to the head and two further down the shaft. The greater tubercle is located at the craniolateral margin of the head and is the insertion point of the supraspinous and infraspinous muscles. The lesser tubercle lies on the medial margin of the head and is the insertion point of the subscapularis muscle. The muscles of greater and lesser tubercle serve primarily to stabilize the shoulder joint and secondarily to move the brachium. Further distally, on the lateral side of the shaft, the deltoid tuberosity marks the insertion of the deltoideus muscle, a major extensor of the brachium. The teres major tuberosity is usually visible on the medial side of the shaft and is the insertion point of the teres major, a major flexor of the brachium. At the distal end of the humerus, a condyle articulates with the radius and ulna to form the elbow joint. The condyle is divided into a medial trochlea, which is a grooved structure that articulates with the ulna, and a lateral capitulum, which is convexly rounded and articulates with the fovea of the radial head. Immediately above the condyle are the medial and lateral epicondyles, which are the points of origin for muscles of the antebrachium. I keep wanting to put an N in there. The medial epicondyle is the point of origin for the pronator teres muscle, which pronates the forearm and the common flexors of the carpus and digits. The lateral epicondyle is the origin of the common extensors of the carpus and digits. Just proximal to the lateral epicondyle is the lateral supracondyle ridge, or supinator crest, from which the supinator muscle arises. In many mammals, an an entepicondylar, entepicondylar foramen runs through the medial epicondyle. The entepicondylar foramen serves as a retinaculum for the median nerve and sometimes the brachial artery. Presence of the canal is the ancestral condition for mammals, but it has been lost independently in many groups that have reduced the epicondyle in association with restricting the ability to abduct the humerus and supinate the forearm. Comparative function. Many of the morphological differences among mammalian humeri have direct functional correlations. The size, shape, and orientation of the tubercles, the orientation of the head, the width of the epicondyles, the shape of the condyle, are often indicative of the range of movements in the forearm and the locomotory style of the animal. For example, in the pronghorn antelope, a cursor, the deltoid and teres major tubercles are proportionally located about a quarter of the way down the shaft. The moment arm for the deltoid and teres major muscles is consequently short, allowing rapid but relatively weak flexion and extension of the forelimb. The same tubercles in the natatorial otter are located nearly halfway down the shaft, providing for proportionally more powerful flexion and extension. The proportions of the epicondylar region in the same species are also quite different. The pronghorn, whose stabilized forearm is incapable of supination, has narrow epicondyles and subsequently short moment arms for the pronator and supinator muscles. The otter has wide epicondyles and a pronounced supinator crest, providing long moment arms for powerful pronation and supination abilities that are used by the animal in swimming and food manipulation. The same phenomenon is seen in the condyles. In the pronghorn, both the trochlea and the capitulum are hinge-like, but in the otter, the capitulum is broadly rounded for rotation of the radial head in supinating movements. In carnivores, cursors without the ability to supinate the forelimb apparently have a restricted maximum body mass, whereas generalists that retain supination can reach very large body sizes. Radius and ulna structure. The radius and ulna make up the forearm, or antebrachium. The radius provides the primary support for the anterior body mass, and the ulna stabilizes the elbow joint and provides a point of insertion for elbow extensors. In some mammals, particularly cursorial ones, these bones are fused and the ulna reduced. The radius has a head at its proximal end, a long shaft, and an enlarged distal extremity with articulation surfaces for the ulna and carpals. The radial head is usually oval in outline with a concave proximal end, the articular fovea. The fovea contacts the capitulum of the humerus. The surface around the margin of the head makes rotational contact with the radial notch of the ulna. On the medial side of the proximal shaft is the radial tuberosity, the insertion point of the radial head of the biceps brachii muscle. The radius usually broadens at its distal end where it articulates with the carpals. On the cranial side, grooves are often visible for the tendons of the abductor pollicis longus, the extensor carpi radialis, and the extensor digitalis. On the lateral surface of this extremity, there is usually a concave ulnar notch that provides a distal point of rotation and of the radius against the ulna. The distal end has a concave articular surface for the scaphoid and lunate bones of the carpus. A radial styloid process projects from the medial side of the distal end. The ulna has a very large proximal end, a tapering body, and usually a distal end with an articular surface for the carpals. The proximal end has a crescent-shaped semilunar notch that receives the trochlea of the humerus. The large olecranon process projects from the proximal end of the ulna and receives the insertions of the extensor muscles, most notably the triceps brachii. The distal border of the trochlear notch terminates in the coronoid process of the ulna, distal to the radial notch, which receives the articular circumference of the radial head. Distal to the coronoid process of the trochlear notch is a concave surface, the radial notch, which receives the articular circumference of the radial head. The distal extremity thickens into the pointed styloid process and has a facet called the ulnar articular circumference that contacts the distal head of the radius. The styloid processes of the ulna and radius provide lateral support for the carpals and are homologous to the radiale and ulnari carpal bones of ancestral tetrapods. Comparative function. The function of the forelimb bones has been an extensively studied subject. Important factors for comparative forelimb function include 1, the degree of fusion of the radius and ulna, 2, the shape of the radial head and corresponding ulnar articular surface, 3, the proportional length of the olecranon process, and 4, the proportional position of the radial and ulnar tuberosities. The degree of fusion and the shape of the radial head help determine the range of pronation-supination movement possible at the manus. Cursorial mammals often have restricted pronation, prosupination, whereas scansorial mammals can usually completely supinate the manus. Pronation-supination movements are accomplished by flipping the distal radius over the distal ulna, rotating the radius about its long axis. As the radius rotates, the radial head rolls within the radial notch of the ulna. Round radial heads roll easily, whereas flattened ones do not. Morphometric ordination of the outline of the radial head alone does a good job of discriminating scansorial, fossorial, ambulatory, and cursorial species. The length of the olecranon determines the moment of effort for forelimb extension. The olecranon is relatively longer in fossorial and natatorial animals, and shorter in cursorial ones. The position of the tuberosities affects the moment arm of effort for forearm flexion. These differences are illustrated by a comparison of the forelimb of a dog with that of a pig. Dogs are relatively agile, medium-weight digitigrade cursors, while pigs are less agile, heavier, unguligrade cursors. The olecranon process, which is the in-lever of the system used to extend the forelimb, is proportionally longer in the pig than in the dog. This gives the pig a more efficient moment arm for extension, which is related partly to the larger mass of the pig, but also to differences in distal limb morphology. Pigs have a longer carpus and manus, which compensate for the relatively short radius and ulna, providing for overall length in the limb. Consequently, the pig has a slower, more powerful extension than the weaker but rapid expansion of the dog. Pigs have a close fit between radius and ulna, which provides stability and completely restricts pronation-supination of the manus. Dogs have a looser fit between the two elements, although supination is restricted compared to some other mammals. Though it is not visible in the figure, the radial head of the dog is ovate, whereas that of the pig has an irregular shape that locks it into the ulnar notch, preventing supination. Manus. The manus consists of the wrist, or carpus, the metacarpus, and the digits. The carpus is composed of a dual series of carpal and sesamoid bones. The proximal series articulates with the radius and ulna, whereas the distal one articulates with the metacarpals. The number and shape of the carpal bones vary among mammalian groups, with both evolutionary fusions and losses of bones having occurred. In the ancestral Therian, there were 3 proximal carpals, from which the medial to lateral are the scaphoid, lunate, and triquetral. The first two articulate with the radius and are fused in many groups, notably in carnivora, and the last articulates with the ulna. The pisiform, a sesamoid bone with the important function inflection of the carpus, lies lateral and caudal to the triquetrum. The distal carpals are, from medial to lateral, the trapezium, trapezoid, capitate, and hamate. The first 3 articulate individually with the first 3 metacarpals, while the 4th carpal articulates with both the 4th and the 5th metacarpals. The triquetral is often in contact with the 5th metacarpal as well. 1 to 5 metacarpal bones, depending on the group, extend distally from the distal carpals. They each have a blocky base with an articular face for the carpals, a long body, and a rounded head with a surface joint for articulation with the digits. Joint surface for articulation with the digits. Usually, the number of metacarpals corresponds directly to the number of digits. Some mammalian groups, such as equids, have reduced the number of metacarpals to only 1, while others retain the ancestral number of 5. Interestingly, the first metacarpal has a growth plate at the proximal and distal ends, as does the first metatarsal, whereas the other 4 have growth plates only at their distal ends. Distal to the metacarpals are the digits, 1 per metacarpal bone, most of which are each composed of 3 phalanges, proximal, middle, and distal. The first digit, the pollex, has only 2 phalanges. The distal phalanx is usually specialized for supporting a nail, claw, or hoof. Comparative function. the manus of mammals differs in extreme and remarkable ways. The number of digits ranges from 1 in equidae, the horses, to 5, the ancestral condition, which is retained in many living groups. Cursorial mammals often have a reduced number of digits, though the number and amount of reduction varies considerably. Canids, for example, have reduced the first digit so that they retain 4 fully functional ones. Tapirs have reduced the first and fifth, leaving 3 large ones. And cervids have reduced digits 1, 2, and 4, functioning with only 2 primary digits. Arboreal animals often have the full complement of 5, usually with an opposable pollex and long metacarpals and phalanges. Bats have extremely elongated digits that support their wing membranes. Seals and sea lions have a broad manus with paddle-like proportions. Most marsupials retain all 5 digits of their manus, regardless of the locomotory specializations of their hind limb. The ubiquity of generalized grasping hands in marsupials may be due to constraints imposed by metatherian reproduction. Metatherian young are born at a very early embryonic stage and continue development attached to the nipple after climbing there with precocially developed forelimbs. Neonatal marsupials are effectively, quote, scansorial, in that they have to climb hand over hand from the vulva to the nipple, requiring them to have well-developed forelimbs and the ability to grasp and pull. Eutherians, with their intrauterine development, are not so constrained and have a much wider diversity of forelimb specialization. Pelvis. Structure. The pelvis anchors the hind limb to the axial skeleton, transmits the weight of the body into the hind limb, and supports and protects the internal organs in the posterior part of the body cavity. The left and right halves of the pelvis are known as the innominate bones, or os coxae. Each innominate is made up of the fusion of the ilium, ischium, pubis, and acetabular bone. The pelvis is attached to the sacrum at the iliac crest, and the two halves are attached to one another at the pubic symphysis. On the lateral faces of the pelvis is a round depression known as the acetabulum that receives the ball of the femur. The obturator foramen, lies on the ventral aspect of the pelvis between the pubis and the ischium. Many mammals, especially living metatherians, have epipubic bones. These slender bones extend cranially into the abdominal wall from the pubis. Whereas textbooks often associate epipubic bones with support of a pouch, or marsupium, they are present in both pouched and pouchless metatherians, and are found in monotremes and early eutherian groups. Comparative function. The shape of the pelvis is closely associated with the body mass and locomotory repertoire of an animal. Differences are most notable in the orientation of the iliac crests and in the shape and depth of the acetabulum. The orientation of the iliac crest is related to the habitual posture of the animal. Bipedal animals, such as humans, have an upright ilium that parallels the vertical orientation of the sacroiliac joint, whereas quadrupedal mammals usually have a horizontal-oriented ilium that parallels their horizontal vertebral column. Orientation is also related to body mass, most notably among quadrupedal species. Heavy mammals tend to have a more upright pelvis than do light ones. Compare the shrew, the dog, the horse, and the elephant. The vertical orientation is capable of supporting greater weight without dislocating the sacroiliac joint or putting undue torsion on the vertebral column. The shape of the acetabulum is also related to the locomotory style. Ambulatory animals have a wide range of hip movements, including significant abduction of the femur. The acetabulum in these animals is more shallow and open than that of cursorial mammals. The lengths and angles of the ilium and ischium relative to the acetabulum also have important functional consequences because the surfaces of these bones are the origination points for most of the extensors and flexors of the hips. The primary extensors of the hip arise from the lateral face of the ilium, the gluteus muscles, and from the ischiatic tuberosity, the semimembranosus, and other muscles. The lengths and angles of these areas of the pelvis thus determine the moment arms for hip extension, which provides forward momentum during locomotion. Most likely, the epipubic bones have multiple functions, including the support of the ventral body wall, influencing movements of the pelvis during locomotion, and support of the young. Interestingly, T.D. White, 1989, found in pouchless marsupials a direct relationship between litter mass, on one hand, and size of epipubic bones and their degree of sexual dimorphism, on the other. However, among pouched species, the relationship was not so strong, suggesting that the litter-supporting function of the bones is greater in species without a pouch, and that other functions predominate in pouched species. Femur. Structure. The femur is a long bone with a distinctive ball-like head at the proximal end and a large triangular distal end with a groove on the cranial side for the patella and patellar tendon. The head is usually located on a restricted neck and is surrounded by three large processes, or trochanters, whose positions help determine the lever advantage for the flexors and extensors of the hip. The greater trochanter arises lateral to the femoral neck and projects proximally. Extensors of the hip, the gluteus medius, gluteus profundus, and piriformis muscles insert into it, or on it. The lesser trochanter lies distal to the head of the caudomedial region of the femur. The iliopsoas muscle, a flexor of the hip, inserts on the lesser trochanter. The third trochanter lies more distally down the body of the femur and is more variable in size from group to group. Another extensor of the hip, the gluteus superficialis muscle, inserts on the third trochanter. The body of the femur is usually long with a rounded cross-section. At the distal end, two condyles curve caudally, with the patellar groove lying between them on the cranial face and the intercondyloid fossa between them on the caudal face. The length and depth of the patellar groove are often correlated with locomotory type. On the caudal side, just above the condyles, are the lateral and medial supracondylar tuberosities, which are the origin of gastrocnemius. There's a C in there. I don't know if it's silent. Comparative function. Some functionally important characters of the femur are 1. The length and orientation of the greater trochanter, 2. The size of the third trochanter, 3. The shape of the head of the and position of the fovea, and 4. The depth of the patellar groove. The greater trochanter functions as a primary lever for extension of the hip. Consequently, it is often long and robust in cursorial mammals. The muscles that insert on the greater trochanter run caudally from the anterior pelvis, pulling the trochanter forward, which helps extend the limb by pivoting it around the head. The longer the trochanter, the more efficient the moment arm for extension. The third trochanter is well developed in cursorial mammals because it is also the insertion point of hip extensors. These muscles run in the opposite direction from the posterior part of the pelvis, from where they pull the distal femur caudally by tugging on the third trochanter. The head of the femur is broader and more proximally directed in species that significantly abduct the femur during locomotion, such as ambulatory mammals. The patellar groove is longer and deeper in cursorial and saltatory. Whoa, what is a saltatory mammal? Than it is in ambulatory or scansorial ones. The patella, or kneecap, itself is a sesamoid bone embedded in the tendon of the quadriceps femoris muscle. The patella rides the patellar groove along with the tendon. The extra depth of the groove provides stabilization for the knee via the patellar tendon. Crus. Structure. The lower hind limb between knee and ankle is the crus and is made up of the tibia and fibula, plus several sesamoid bones. In most mammals, the tibia is the larger bone. It lies medial to the fibula and supports most of the body weight. The proximal end flares at the knee joint and tapers distally into a long body. The proximal articular surface is divided into a lateral and medial condyle with an intercondyloid eminence between them. Just distal to the articular surface on the cranial border is the tibial tuberosity, which is the insertion point of the quadriceps femoris and sartorius muscles. A small articulation surface for the fibular head is located on the lateral side of the proximal end. The position of the contact between tibia and fibula varies considerably among mammal groups. In placentals, the articulation is just distal to the margin of the lateral condyle, whereas in monotremes and many marsupials, the contact is at the margin itself, often with the head of the fibula extending proximally to the level of the distal femur. At the distal end, the tibia flares again, with an articular surface for the ankle joint. The articular surface is often grooved, sometimes quite deeply, to receive ridges of the astragalus. A distal projection on the medial side forms the medial malleolus, which wraps around the medial face of the astragalar trochlea. In some taxa, the articular surface and malleolus tightly envelop the astragalus, restricting movement to the parasagittal plane, whereas in others, especially marsupials, the articulation is more open, allowing more freedom of movement for the foot. The lateral side of the distal tibia has an articular surface for contact with the fibula. The fibula is usually thin, especially in eutherians, and serves mostly for muscle attachment and to stabilize the lateral ankle joint. In some taxa, the fibula is fused to the tibia, and in some, it is extremely reduced. The proximal head is usually enlarged and has a small articulation surface for contact with the tibia. The distal end is enlarged into the lateral malleolus, which usually participates in forming the ankle joint. Comparative function. Functional variety in the tibia and fibula is not as visually obvious as it is in other limb structures. The most conspicuous functional differences are seen in the distal articular surface of the tibia. This joint surface can be deeply grooved in cursorial mammals, spiraled in species with significant limb abduction, some ambulatory mammals, or those capable of hind foot reversal, scansorial mammals, or comparatively flat, some ambulatory and scansorial species. The shape of the surface contributes to the degree of ankle specialization and parasagittal movement. The degree of fusion in the fibula also varies among mammals, but mostly in relation to body mass. The tibia and fibula are often fused at the distal end in smallest mammals, and occasionally in saltatory or cursorial mammals. Freedom of the fibula enhances the abduction-adduction of the ankle, which can be important for scansorial mammals, especially marsupials, which normally have a proportionally large fibula. Pes. Structure. The ankle, or tarsus, consists of several blocky bones. The ancestral Therian had 7 tarsal bones, a number that has been reduced in some cases by loss or fusion of the elements. The largest tarsals are the calcaneum and the astragalus, also known as the talus in medical terminology. These bones, especially the astragalus, articulate with the crus at the tibiotarsal or upper ankle joint. The astragalus is divided into a body, neck, and distal head. The proximal or dorsal surface of the body forms the tibial articular surface, or trochlea. The shape of the trochlear surface mirrors the shape of the distal articular surface of the tibia. In most groups, the trochlea has articular surfaces on its medial and lateral faces, which articulate with inner surfaces of the malleoli of the tibia and fibula, respectively. Facets for articulation with the calcaneum are found on the plantar surface. The neck and head lie distal to the body. The head articulates with the navicular bone, and the neck, sometimes called head, contacts the calcaneum, sometimes the cuboid bone. The calcaneum is elongate with the long axis paralleling the long axis of the foot. A large calcaneal process or tuber projects caudally and is the point of insertion for large tendons of the calf muscles. The calcaneum has a large facet for articulation with the astragalus on its dorsal side and for the cuboid on its distal end. In many mammals, especially eutherians, a large process called the sustentaculum astragali projects from the medial side of the calcaneum to support the neck of the astragalus. The joint between the astragalus and calcaneum is the astragalocalcaneal, or lower ankle joint. The navicular bone lies distal to the astragalar head and the cuboid distal to the calcaneum. The joint between the proximal and distal tarsals is the transverse tarsal joint, which is composed of the astragonavicular joint and the calcaneocuboid joint. Man, these are fun. Distal to the navicular and medial to the cuboid are the lateral, intermediate, and medial cuneiforms. These and the cuboid collectively articulate with the metatarsals. Comparative function. Like the manis, the functional morphology of the pes is complex and varied, so only a few aspects will be considered here. Comparative movements of the pes can most easily be understood by considering several major joints and axes of rotation. The upper ankle joint is the primary joint for dorsiflexion and plantar flexion, and it is the point where force is transmitted between crus and pes. The shape of the upper ankle joint surface has both taxonomic and functional variety. The upper ankle joint of metatherians has a relatively smooth, simple structure where some adduction and adduction occurs along with dorsi and plantar flexion. In didelphids, the astragalus is mediolaterally expanded so that it has three facets, two for the tibia and one for the fibula, which is a weight-bearing bone. The upper ankle joint of eutherians usually has a sculpted surface, often with two ridges along the edges of the astragalar trochlea, with corresponding grooves in the distal tibial articulation. These ridges and grooves have the slightest relief in cursorial and saltatorial mammals, where they restrict plantar flexion to a parasagittal plane and provide stabilization for the ankle. The upper ankle joint of multituberculates is markedly different from the same structure in therians, in that the distal tibia bears two condyles rather than a single concavity, and the astragalus has dual grooves rather than ridges. The shape of these surfaces is spiraled to facilitate hindfoot reversal. The lower ankle joint is also functionally diverse, and movement there may occur in many circumstances. In some taxa, the lower ankle joint is especially important in hindfoot inversion, useful to scansorial mammals, because specialized facets allow the calcaneum to slide around the astragalus and so twist the distal foot into an inverted position. The lower ankle joint is tightly locked in cursorial mammals to prevent inversion and other distal foot rotation. The transverse tarsal joint varies similarly, with considerable rotation in mammals capable of hindfoot inversion, but tight interlocking in cursorial mammals. The observation is worth making that pronation and supination of the manus are accomplished by movement in the forelimb, but that inversion and eversion of the pes are accomplished at tarsal joints. Ecomorphologic diversity of mammalian limbs. Mammalian limbs are often categorized into locomotory or ecomorphologic types. Locomotory classifications have been based on gaits, on combinations of musculoskeletal features, on limb ratios, and on combinations of these criteria. Systems have also been proposed for specific taxonomic groups. Many authors have lamented that locomotory classification schemes are not specific enough to be useful, but in most cases, increased specificity inhibits broad applicability. In this chapter, only a few general ecomorphologic categories will be discussed, primarily because only very loose groupings can be applied across the whole of mammalia. Overviews of limb mechanics and functional diversity are found in Flower, 1870, Muybridge, 1893, Howell, 1944, Tricker, 1967, Gambarian, 1974, Oxnard, 1984, Hildebrand, 1988, and Alexander, 1983A, 2002. Generalized or ambulatory mammals. Some mammals do not have obvious specializations for any particular locomotor style, substrate, or activity, and are often categorized as, quote, generalized or, quote, ambulatory. The raccoon, Procyon loder, and the opossum, Didelphis virginiana, are examples of generalized or ambulatory mammals. Walking, running, climbing, and manipulating objects are all possible for ambulatory mammals because they do not have skeletal specializations that limit any particular activity. Ambulatory mammals have relatively mobile joints, the ability to pronate supinate the manus, five digits, often with opposable hallux and pollux, and a plantigrade to semi-digitigrade posture. The proportions of the three limb segments are roughly equal. See Marmota, Spermophilus, and Rattus data in plate 15.1. Ambulatory mammals range in body size from small through medium to large. I read that very poorly. Ambulatory mammals range in body size from small through medium to large. Several skeletal traits are associated with an ambulatory mode of locomotion. The scapula is often triangular, providing a powerful moment arm for the flexors of the forearm. The deltoid crest of the humerus is often prominent and positioned well down the length of the shaft, almost to the midpoint in some cases. Ambulatory mammals often have a clavicle. The supinator crest is large, the capitulum is rounded, the radial head is ovate to circular in outline, and the radius and ulna are not fused, allowing supination of the manus. Ambulatory species have a wide range of hip movements, including significant abduction. Their acetabulae are accordingly open, and the balls of their femora are broadly rounded, and the ankle of the neck is obtuse relative to the axis of the femoral shaft. The tarsal joints permit a variety of movements, including some abduction and adduction at the upper ankle joint in marsupials. Cursorial specializations. Many ungulates and carnivores have specializations that allow greater running speeds, specializations that are called, quote, cursorial. Horses, goitered gazelles, and cheetahs are examples of mammals with well-developed cursorial traits. Cursorial animals typically have relatively long limbs, with distal segments proportionally longer than proximal ones. The posture of cursors is usually digitigrade or unguligrade. Limb joints, especially in the hind limb, are often structured to permit only parasagittal motion, which stabilizes them against mediolateral collapse during running. The scapula of cursors tends to be long with a short teres process. The reduction or loss of the clavicle further enhances scapular mobility and parasagittal flexion and extension of the forelimb. The deltoid and teres tuberosities of the humerus are proximally located. Restriction of the ability to supinate the manus and invert the pes contributes to joint stabilization. The pelvis and thigh of cursors are organized to maximize parasagittal movement, which is most obvious in the cylindrical nature of the acetabulum and the horizontal orientation of the femoral neck. The carpals and tarsals are often closely packed and structured to inhibit movements among them. The tibio-tarsal joint has a hinge or groove structure that stabilizes it and restricts flexion and extension of the foot to a parasagittal plane. The metapodials and proximal phalanges are often greatly elongated, which increases the length of stride. The peripheral digits of cursors are often reduced or lost, the most extreme example being in horses, where the number is reduced to one. The shapes of bones and the positions of muscle origins and insertions give cursors a high, quote, gear ratio. The combination of short in levers and long out levers produces rapid translation of the manus and pes, but comparatively little power. Consequently, cursors have specializations that lighten the distal limb. The number of digits is often reduced, with the single digit found in the horse being an extreme example. Muscles are in the distal segment are also reduced. Centrifugal force, elongated tendons, and spring ligaments often combine to assist with segment extension. The limbs of cursors may not be optimized for maximal speed, as suggested by Howell, 1944, but for minimization of locomotory energy costs, Gambarian, 1974, Garland and Janis, 1993, Christensen, 2002. Saltatory specializations. Some desert and grassland mammals have specializations for jumping or saltation. Oh, neat. That's what it means. Many saltatory specializations are simply exaggerations of cursorial ones, such as long distal limb segments, high gear ratios, digit reduction, and hinged joints. However, bipedal saltators, such as the red kangaroo, Macropodus rufus, or the jerboa, Jaculus, differ markedly from their quadrupedal counterparts in that their fore and hind limbs have dissimilar specializations because saltation is performed bipedally. The forelimbs of saltatory animals often resemble those of ambulatory or scansorial species, particularly the mobile elements and grasping hands. Consequently, saltators can be recognized from their limb ratios because of their proportionally shorter manus than pes. Because saltators move bipedally, they must balance their weight over the hind limb. In many species, a long, heavy tail counterbalances the weight of the forelimbs and head. Saltators use their hind limbs for propulsion, weight, support, and maneuverability, which requires a stable hindfoot. Many saltators have a tridactyl foot, which provides stability and allows adjustment to direction of movement. Despite claims that bipedal saltation might be more energy efficient for covering the distances necessary to forage in the desert, some studies have found that bipedal and quadrupedal locomotion are similar in energy costs at typical foraging speeds. scansorial specializations. Scansorial, or climbing mammals, characteristically have mobile limbs and the ability to grasp with their hands and often their feet. The terms, quote, scansorial and, quote, arboreal have an overlapping usage. Here, scansorial is used for a general climbing locomotory category, whereas arboreal is used only in reference to species that live in trees. Scansorial locomotion is found in many mammal groups, and examples include divergent species such as the red squirrel, the howler monkey, the three-toed sloth, the kinkajou, and the tree kangaroo. Most primates, all scandentians, tree shrews, and many rodents, didelphids, and carnivores are scansorial to a greater or lesser degree. However, there's considerable diversity in the amount of time spent climbing, the method and speed of climbing, and the morphological structures that can clearly be associated with a scansorial lifestyle. Some climbers suspend themselves from tree limbs, such as sloths or gibbons, and have elongated limbs. Others, such as tree squirrels, scamper on limbs and climb by clinging to projections and irregularities. And yet others, such as tarsiers, spring from place to place in the trees. Some scansers spend their entire lives in the trees, while others climb only occasionally. Universal scansorial features are thus difficult to identify. Caveats aside, some features are stereotypical of scansers. Most are plantigrade and have grasping feet and hands. In some cases, the manus and pes have become elongated, either at the tarsus for jumping scansers or at the metatarsus and digits in suspensory and brachiating mammals. Suspensory species, such as sloths, have highly modified distal phalanges with long, curved claws for grasping. Many scansorial species have long, dorsoventrally thickened claws. In almost all cases, the forelimb is capable of extensive pronation and supination, and the radius is mobile with a rounded head. The clavicle is often present, which stabilizes the shoulder, and the scapula is often triangular. The limbs as a whole are often elongated, the forelimb more than the hind limb in brachiating species. Many scansorial mammals have prehensile tails. Fossorial specializations. Some mammals have fossorial or digging adaptations. Fossorial mammals include those that dig occasionally in pursuit of food or in the construction of burrows, such as badgers and wombats, and those that live most of their lives below the surface, such as mole rats and moles. Many insectivorous mammals, especially those that eat ants, also have fossorial specializations, including armadillos, pangolins, and anteaters. Fossorial specializations are most pronounced in the forelimbs, which are the primary tools of excavation. In all fossorial mammals, limbs have a, quote, low gear ratio, which emphasizes the strength of extension rather than speed. In semi-fossorial burrowers, such as the wombat, the low gear ratio is manifested in the long teres process of the scapula, which increases the moment of the teres major muscle, the strong deltoid and teres tubercles, and the long olecranon process of the ulna. In subterranean mammals, such as moles, the differences are more extreme. The manubrium of the sternum is long, which moves the pectoral girdle forward so that it is at the very front of the animal. The clavicles are short, which pull the shoulders close to the body. The scapula is extremely long and narrow, and the humeri are bizarrely shaped with large tubercles for muscles of flexion, extension, abduction, and adduction. The radius and ulna are tightly interlocked. The olecranon process is long and robust, and the distal articular surfaces of both bones are flared to provide an inflexible with interlocking to provide a massive contact with the carpus, and the manus is broad and inflexible, with interlocking carpals, extremely short metacarpals and phalanges, and long, thick claws. Adaptations for digging are covered in more detail elsewhere in this volume. Natatorial specializations. Some mammals are adapted to life in water, and those that use limbs as their primary means of propulsion are called natatorial. The most extreme examples are cetaceans, or seals, sea lions, and walruses. However, many other animals swim regularly, such as beavers, otters, nutrias, water voles, and water shrews. Depending on the degree of specialization, mammals may be classified as natatorial, swimming, or aquatic. Natatorial features of the forelimb are similar to those of the semi-fossorial mammals, but in swimmers, the hind limbs are also specialized. Swimmers require powerful forelimb extension for pushing through the dense medium of the water. Accordingly, natatorial mammals have large teres processes, short humeri with large deltoid and teres tubercles, and long ulnar olecranon process. Unlike diggers, swimmers have an elongated manus with especially long digits. The proximal hind limb is sometimes reduced in length, but the crus is often long and the pes paddle-like. In many cases, the toes are webbed, like in the beaver, or have become flippers, as in seals and sea lions. The sternum of natatorial mammals is often reduced, and the clavicles are usually absent. Aquatic and natatorial adaptations are covered in detail elsewhere. Graviportal specializations. Mammals with extremely large body masses require special features simply to support their weight during locomotion. Animals that show such skeletal specializations are said to be graviportal. The most obvious graviportal features are the diameter of the limb bones, which are disproportionately large to support a body mass that has increased as the cube of body length. The orientation of the pelvis is also a notable graviportal feature. The orientation of the ilium is highly correlated with body mass, and it becomes more vertical as mass increases. The vertical orientation reduces the torque placed on the pelvis and sacrum under large loads. It is often said that decreased length of the distal limb segments, especially the metapodials and digits, is a graviportal specialization, but close inspection of plate 15.1 shows that this is not the case. In the plate, the standardized lengths of the proximal, middle, and distal limb segments of both the forelimb and hind limb are shown. They have been ordered by the relative length of the pes, with the longest at the top of the graph and the shortest at the bottom. Elephants, which are some of the very largest living land animals, are indeed found at the bottom of the graph because of the reduced length of their manus and pes. However, the next heaviest animal, the giraffe, is at the top because of its proportionally long manus and pes. Other mammals, such as the bison, are found scattered through, suggesting that the short manus and pes of the elephants is a feature specific to proboscidea, and not an adaptation to larger body mass. Bipedality. An unusual locomotory specialization of mammals is non-saltatory bipedalism. Humans are the only habitual non-jumping bipeds, although some other species, mostly primates and bears, are facultative bipeds. Bipeds are typically plantigrade, have short tails. What do you mean typically? We only have one. I guess if you count bears, they have short tails. And vertically oriented pelvises. Your sample size is one for this. The human hind limb has unique specializations for bipedalism, which include a short flared ilium, an extremely long femur, a downturned tuber of the calcaneum, and a large elongated pollex. Variability, genetics, and development in mammalian limbs. The interplay between structure, function, and development makes mammalian limbs a particularly interesting system, one that remains fertile despite its long history of study. The mammal limb skeleton has a particularly high genetic component. The size, shape, and structure of limb bones are sufficiently distinctive so as to reliably indicate the species from which it came. And the phylogenetic continuity of the limb structure is remarkable, even though superficial homoplastic resemblances develop as rapid evolution scampers across the same substrates again and again. In another sense, though, limbs are improbably plastic. Bones remodel rapidly in response to the stress and strain they may encounter. Habitual exertion can leave a marked impact on the structure of limbs, from bow-legged cowboys to asymmetrically armed Anglo-Saxon bowmen to the eerily human-like pelvis of Slijber's bipedal goat. What? Okay, I'll have to look that up later. Excision and tendon severing of experiments suggests that the structure of limb bones is due more to the forces impinging on them than to anything fundamentally heritable. The ecophenotypic plasticity of limb skeleton suggests a lack of heritable variants. Some have suggested that the latter has wrongly encouraged systematists to reject limb characters from phylogenetic analyses. Almost in contradiction, patterns of expression of intrinsic skeletal genes are known to influence morphology and have been used to explain evolutionary transformations. The evolutionary transformations of the limb are clearly a fuzzy combination of the genetic and epigenetic, the selective and the ecophenotypic, non-genetic, life historical, the developmental, and the functional. Mammal limbs provide a potentially fruitful venue for exploring the interaction among these factors because they have a greater structural complexity in terms of muscles and bony features than those of other vertebrates, allowing for a greater diversity of approach to functional interpretation. Mammals have evolved a greater functional diversity than other vertebrate groups, and the mammalian fossil record is particularly rich in its postcrania. Selected literature on variability, genetics, and development in mammalian limbs is reviewed here. In considering variability, it is important to distinguish between ontogenetic variation, population variation, and interspecific or evolutionary variation. Ontogenetic and population variation are discussed in this section and related to intraspecific variation, which was discussed above. It is also important to distinguish among variation in different kinds of traits. Variation can be in the dimensions of bones, either uniformly as, quote, size, or non-uniformly as, quote, shape. Variation can be in the structure of limb elements, such as the surface shape of a joint articulation, for example, and variation can be polymorphic, such as polydactyly. These different types of trait probably have radically different genetic and epigenetic underpinnings. Consequently, quantitative or experimental data on one type of trait may have little explanatory power over another. Trait types may be functionally integrated, however, as the previous discussion of limb segment ratios and skeletal structure demonstrates. Quantitative variability. Variation in the dimensions of limb bones has been studied since Galileo noted in 1637 that the diameter of long bones is disproportionately large compared to their lengths in mammals with large body mass. The functional correlates of quantitative variation in mammal limbs have been the subject of many recent interesting studies, and the relationship is becoming reasonably well understood. But what is the genetic and developmental context of the evolution of quantitative aspects of limb morphology? One fundamental issue is the extent to which limb size traits are heritable. It is well known that environmental factors such as nutrition and body mass can affect limb dimensions, so it is interesting to know how much of the variance in limb elements is genetic. There may have been a few studies of heritability in limb elements, except for a series of papers. Sorry, there have been few studies of heritability in limb elements, except for a series of papers on the quantitative genetics of skeletal traits in mice by Leamy and co-workers, 1974, 1975, 1977, 1981, Leamy and Bradley, 1982, Leamy and Sustarczyk, in 1978. These studies considered osteological traits of the skull and limbs, along with the measures of body size. Several limb traits were included: innominate length, ilium length, obturator foramen, all pelvis traits, femur length, tibia length, scapula length, humerus length, and radio-ulna length. These traits collectively represent all the segments of both limbs, excluding the feet themselves. Heritability of limb element lengths in mice was high, on average slightly higher than skull or body traits. This result dispels the notion that limb traits exhibit greater non-genetic ecophenotypic variation than do dental or skull traits. Heritability of forelimb elements was generally higher than for those of the hind limb, but the two were comparable. A multivariate component analysis grouped osteological traits into relative factors, including a skull factor, a limb factor, a pelvic factor, and a width factor. The pelvis thus appears to be partly dissociated from other limb traits, including the scapula. Even though the heritability of limb traits is high, they do not appear to evolve as quickly on microevolutionary time scales as do molar or skull traits. Leamy and Sustarczyk, 1978, looked at variation between different inbred lines of mice, finding that limb traits did not differ as much as did tooth traits. Despite their possibly slower rate, limb traits do evolve on very small evolutionary timescales. Schnell and Solander, 1981, found that pelvic length showed greater differentiation among populations of mus musculus musculus, and M. musculus domesticus, than did ulna length or hindfoot length. Means of ulna length, condylar width of the humerus, pelvic length, and hindfoot length were significantly different in the two subspecies. A high heritability does not in itself explain the mechanism by which the heritable variance is known to be A high heritability does not in itself explain the mechanism by which the heritable variance is transmitted. Limb traits have long been known to be pleiotropic, or influenced by many genes, and now a bewildering array of genes have been identified that are active during various stages of limb development. These genes interact in complex, dynamic ways to produce skeletal structures, and their contribution to gross heritability in limb measurements is not straightforward. For example, Hox genes are involved in patterning the segments of the limbs, but so does pleiotropin, an extracellular growth differentiation factor, which is expressed long after limb patterning takes place. Both genes act directly on skeletal development, but there are other sources of heritable variants that act indirectly through non-skeletal tissues. The muscular and vascular systems are the most obvious sources of such epigenetic interactions, but less obvious sources, such as the nervous system, also have an effect on skeletal development. Heritable variants may also be transmitted through interactions among elements of the limb skeleton themselves. As early excision experiments indicate. For example, the removal of part of either the radius or ulna results in an increase in the thickness and a decrease in the length of the other bone. Habitual behaviors can also contribute to heritable variation, or at least to species-specific limb morphology. Modified behaviors have a demonstrable effect on the limb skeleton, as observation of habitually bipedal rats and goats has shown. Whereas bipedal goats and rats are so extreme as to be unlikely in the, quote, natural world, learning behaviors such as gait or resting posture may have a substantial effect on limb bones and may contribute to the shared morphology of a population or species. Some journals discourage morphometric studies of limb skeleton of zoo animals because the systematic effects of captive life can exert on limb morphology. Polymorphic variability. Limb elements may exhibit polymorphic variability, or multiple discontinuous manifestations of a trait within the same population. Examples of polymorphic variation include polydactyly, supernumerary bones or muscles, or achondroplastic dwarfism. The most common polymorphisms involve missing bones or parts of bones associated with otherwise normal tissues. Most of these types of polymorphism are caused by events that happen after the basic limb pattern is specified. Recently, Packard et al., 1993, argued that such malformations are caused primarily by teratogenic effects on the arterial system rather than the skeletal system per se. Development of the arterial system is closely associated with the development of the skeletal system, and its malformation impedes the normal development of the bone. The non-heritable condition of mice in which fibulae and feet are both missing, but the rest of the skeleton is normal, is probably an example. Not all losses of limb elements are teratogenic, however. The mouse polydactylous condition, known as, quote, luxate, produces a reduced or absent tibia, which is replaced by a ligament. The fibula is also malformed, usually bent, and medial digits are polydactylous. The luxate condition has a semi-dominant inheritance pattern and is caused by a mutation that reduces the size of the domain of FGF8 expression in the preaxial radial side of the limb at the initial stage of limb development. The reduction of the FGF domain allows SHH to be expressed more anteriorly, which expands the expression domains of the other genes normally confined to the posterior bud. The result is polydactyly of the anterior digits. The gene involved in mouse luxate mutation is known to be a member of a large family of luxoid genes. Interestingly, Grunberg, 1952, reported that there are several types of inherited preaxial polydactylism in mammals, but postaxial polydactylism is much rarer. The example of the luxate condition illustrates the possibility that some common genetic limb polymorphisms may have few evolutionary consequences. luxate limbs, though heritable, are so universally detrimental that they are almost certain to be removed from a population by selection, even though mutations leading to the condition are common enough for luxoid conditions to be taphonomically widespread. Other limb polymorphisms exist that may be of evolutionary significance, however. For example, Yablokov, 1974, reported that the pisiform and some distal carpals were variably absent in Delphinapterus lucus, the beluga whale, and that extra elements were commonly present between the proximal and distal carpals. Whales as a group are characterized by hyperphalange, or the possession of extra phalanges in the digits, and the variation described by Yablokov is probably not detrimental for whales as it would be for horses. The condition of having extra elements was apparently heritable in the belugas because similar carpal patterns were found in mothers and calves. Another limb polymorphism with interesting patterns of variation was found also in belugas, whose fourth digit is often forked, a comparatively rare postaxial polydactyl condition. In few populations, however, the fifth digit rather than the fourth is bifid. Ulbrich, 1985a, argued that the distribution of supernumerary and vestigial digits among breeds of domestic dog is due to a completely unrelated phenomenon, the number of cells in the developing limb buds. Ulbrich argued that the number of digits was a function of the size or number of the cells in the developing limb bud. He argued that a critical mass of cells was required before the condensation of onlage could occur. Small breeds fell below the required threshold and often lacked a digit, whereas large breeds had more than the requisite number of cells and sometimes had an extra digit. This mechanism of polymorphic variation is an example of an interactive effect between size and the number of digits. Land, 1978, provided an interesting worked example from a population genetics perspective of how such interactive polymorphisms might evolve. An interesting limb polymorphism with widespread pathological occurrence, but which is the norm in some mammal groups, is syndactyly, a large clade of Australian marsupials. The syndactyla share an unusual hindfoot morphology in which digits 2 and 3 are completely gracile and are bound together as a single toe. This syndactylous condition is found homologously in paramelids, notoricteids, phalangerids, vombatids, and macropodids. In these marsupials, syndactyly is the normal condition. It is heritable, and it is not associated with other major skeletal abnormalities. Syndactyly is a widespread pathology in other groups of mammals, however, where it is usually accompanied by other defects. Grunberg, 1952, reported a bilateral defect of the radius, in which carpals, metacarpals, and digits on the radial side of the hand were also missing, and digits 3 and 4 were syndactylous. He also reviewed a defect in mice in which both hind limbs were completely missing, but the pelvis had associated defects, and digits 2 and 3 of the forelimb were syndactylous. These conditions were probably not heritable, and both were extremely detrimental to the individuals that had them. Other examples of syndactyly are heritable, but also have associated detrimental effects, such as oculodentodigital dysplasia in humans. The disjunction between syndactyly and other skeletal and non-skeletal effects suggests that the molecular development pathway leading to marsupial syndactylism is different in commonly studied pathologies. In the marsupials, the syndactylous condition was fixed in the ancestral population only through the conjunction of heritability, disassociation with other detrimental effects, and functional suitability. These examples indicate that polymorphic variation can be either genetic or ecophenotypic, and that the ultimate cause of polymorphisms may be associated directly with skeletal developmental system, as in the luxate condition, or indirectly with another system, such as the arterial one. Early diversification of the mammalian limb. Most evolutionary scenarios put the ancestors of placental and marsupial mammals in the trees. The view that ancestral therian mammals were arboreal has been around since the early 20th century, when Matthew, 1904, argued that ancestral placental mammals may have had opposable digits on the manus and pes. Matthew was extending to placentals an earlier argument that marsupials had an arboreal ancestry. saying that the, quote, Cretaceous ancestors of tertiary mammals were small arboreal animals of very uniform skeletal characters, but probably somewhat differentiated in dentition according as fruit, seeds, and nuts, or insects, formed the staple of their diet, unquote. Matthew's argument was based on an analysis of skeletal characters, primarily from the placental mammals in the early Cenozoic fossil record. The arboreal origin of mammals has not gone unquestioned, however. Haynes, 1958, presented detailed comparative and anatomical data on the feet of mammals and concluded that the earliest then-known placentals were probably terrestrial and that Cretaceous forests would have had little to offer mammals. Sasley, 1994, reiterated the possibility that the earliest placental mammals were terrestrial and argued that scansorial adaptations in placentals, especially archontans, might not be homologous with scansorial features in the ancestral marsupial. A lively literature has grown up around the debate, which obviously remains open. Recent finds show that early mammals were more diverse in their postcranial skeleton and locomotory habits than Matthew imagined, however. New limb morphologies have been found in eutherians and other groups of Mesozoic mammals. It is now clear that early mammals, far from being a homogeneous group of arboreal specialists, inhabited a broad range of ecological niches, partitioned by substrate, diet, body mass, and geography. Two triconodonts, members of a paraphyletic group of mammals known from the late Jurassic and early Cretaceous, are now known from their postcranial skeletons, the late Jurassic Jeholodons, Jenkinski from China, and the early Cretaceous Gobioconodon Ostromi from North America. Jeholodons, is that right? Jeholodons, that's such a weird word, are most likely a terrestrial plantigrade animal. The arrangement of tarsals is like non-mammalian cynodonts, monotremes, and multituberculates in having the axis of rotation of the upper ankle joint at an oblique angle to the main axis of the foot, a condition that suggests a posture that was sprawling. The calcaneum had a tubercle, but the astragalus was not subtended by the calcaneum as it is in therians. One of the most surprising features of Jeholodons and Gobiconodon is that they had a scapular spine. Unlike other scapular features, the spine is a specialized structure not found in monotremes, multituberculates, or Morganucodon. Traditionally, the spine was thought to have evolved from the cranial border of the scapula in non-mammals. It was thought that the spine had evolved by the addition of a supraspinous portion to the blade, leaving a spine running along the junction of the neomorph and the, quote, old scapula. Paleontological and developmental information now suggests that the spine itself is the novelty, formed developmentally and evolutionarily speaking, as part of the reorganization of the trapezius and deltoid musculature associated with the evolution of upright posture and more mobile pectoral girdle. The spine of Jeholodons and Gobiconodon suggests that these triconodonts had a muscular anatomy that permitted extensive movement of the pectoral girdle during locomotion. Developmental studies support the distinction between the spine and the rest of the scapula. The spine develops in one of three ways: by apposition in the acromion, as an independent condensation, or as an intermuscular ossification. In all cases, the spine has a developmental origin separate from the acromion process, which has its own condensational history and distinctive pattern of HOX 5A and PAX 1 expression. Other important discoveries have come from the postcrania of multituberculates. Multituberculates were a diverse group of rodent-like animals that flourished in the Cretaceous and early tertiary, but their postcrania have been almost completely unknown. A skeleton of Tylodus cumae from the Paleocene of North America demonstrated specialized arboreal features, including a unique upper ankle joint that facilitated squirrel-like hindfoot reversal. Subsequent discoveries indicate that multituberculates retained an interclavicle, and that the humerus had significant torsion, that the humerus had no trochlea, and that the calcaneum contacted the fifth metatarsal, compare the therian and non-therian feet, and that in multituberculates, that multituberculates had a posture that was much more sprawling than that of therians. The tarsus of Cryptobatar,
Dashvegi, and Tylotus kume is shorter and broader than Therian mammals, with a wide astragalus and a calcaneum whose tuber is angled posterolateral to the main axis of the metatarsus. Most likely, the parasagittal stance is a specifically Therian condition, not found in more broadly among mammals. Considerable locomotory diversity existed among multituberculates, as indicated by the humeral differences among Bulganbatar, Lambdosalus, and Cryptobatar. Several new skeletons have also expanded our picture of Eutherian limb diversity. One of the most striking is the 125 million year old Eomaya scansoria from the early Cretaceous of China. A contemporary of Gehalodon's, Eomaya had many of the features associated with the Therian and Eutherian skeleton. It had a mobile scapula with a well-developed spine, a well-developed ulnar olecranon and calcaneal tuber, an upright parasagittal posture, a fibula that was significantly more gracile than the tibia, an astragalus subtended by the calcaneus, an astragalar trochlea, and a calcaneum that was separated from the metatarsals by the navicular, and a long axis of the metatarsus that was roughly perpendicular to the axis of rotation in the upper ankle joint. Eomaya has been interpreted as being arboreal, although that interpretation is not universally accepted. Other important Eutherian limb skeletons have been described recently and include Eucatotherium nesovi, an Asoriictothere from the late Cretaceous of Mongolia, and Decanolestes hislopi from the late Cretaceous of India. Whereas the diversity in mammal limb structure today evolved over the last 140 million years since the last common ancestor of marsupials and placentals, limb and substrate diversity was already varied in the Mesozoic. The earliest known placental, Eomaya, was a scansorial tree dweller. Zhangiotherium, a Therian contemporary of Eomaya, was terrestrial, as was... As was Gehalodon's. Because of structural correlates to limb function, many locomotory aspects of a mammal can be reliably interpreted from its skeleton, even when it is extinct with no exact analogs among the living. The evolutionary migration of mammals through changing environments and habitats can be traced using the bones of the same legs that carried them on daily forays during their lives. The constant requirements of support and movement mean that habitat, behavior, and growth are intertwined with bone, muscle, and tendon in phylogenetic transformations. One aspect can hardly change without the others doing likewise.